John Stevenson is the owner of Stevenson Forecourt, a family-owned independent based in the northeast of England with three sites. Today, John talks to us about how the business evolved from car dealerships with forecourts right through to amazing shops that also sell fuel. He also talks about how the business has overcome the challenges involved in its growth. Here's John Stevenson. So Stevenson Forecourts have been around since 1978, started by your dad, with a first forecourt in Middlesbrough. So tell me a bit about the background of the business and how it got to where it is today.
It started in 1978, like you say, when Dad got his first petrol site. Previous, it was a leasehold or dealer site from Mobile. Before that, he was a mechanic with his own workshops. This guy actually had a workshop attached to the side of it. It was in Marton in Middlesbrough. So that was the year I was born. He then built it up over the next few years. He got four or five dealer sites around the northeast with Mobile. My brother and I used to get driven around in the back of his Volvo with the seats facing out the boot, eating copious amounts of sweets just to keep us quiet in the back. Them sites seemed to do quite well for Dad. He was living his dream, I think, building the business, employing quite a lot of staff members, and the business was growing at quite a good rate for him. He was really happy. He then bought a freehold site, which was actually an ex-Ford main dealership in 1984 in Stockton, which is the site I'm sat in now. That needed quite a bit of work doing to that. Because it was freehold, he was able to do this. It was the first time he really had to do much on a site. He had to pull quite a bit of workshop down to fit a petrol station onto it. When he finished his development, it left him a showroom, workshops, big reception area, and he created a new three-pump forecourt with a shop on it. Video library went in, which he was doing in some of the dealer sites in Mobile. He used to make quite a bit of money on the memberships from the video library.
And when you say video library, do you mean like Blockbuster?
Yeah, like VHS videos, yeah. Like, it was crazy. I grew up in these. Dad getting sent Goonie jumpers and Gremlin jumpers. They're amazing things, just walls of videos that you would take to a little hatch and someone would put it into a takeout box. Even when I joined the business in 99 full-time, we still have 1.5 video libraries. That was something I had to take out, actually. Much to Dad's dismay at the time, I think. But yeah, he opened that, got involved in cars, actually. He had a showroom and workshops there. So he ended up taking a Mazda new car franchise on in 1986. That went really well for him in the late 80s. He then decided, it was a decision of quite a few people to start and build a new site over in Middlesbrough just for the Mazdas. So 1989, planning process started, contract signed to start building this huge Mazda dealership, described by some of the top people in Mazda as possibly one of the best Mazda facilities in Europe. And this thing was huge. It had a bird's nest waiting area in the showroom. And 1990, mid-build, this huge recession. I was only young at the time, but I think it was mid-1990s, quite a nasty old recession was crunching. Dad was committed, couldn't turn anything back. He had to finish the build. He ended up opening this big flashy Mazda dealership, selling half the number of cars he sold at the freehold site. He had virtually no overhead. I think he was making half the amount of margin on them. So he had a very painful 5 years, something like £1 million lost. I've seen the accounts, very painful for him. He ended up having to get rid of four or five of the dealer sites, which really were his cash cows, but to free up some cash, he had to get rid of them. That left him in 1996 with two dealer sites left with Mobile and the freehold site. I was at university, could see obviously the pain and suffering that he endured. His head was down, lost his mojo. I was coming back from university helping him out. But as a kid, I've always been interested in the sites, loved it. At 11, 12, there was a site near where I lived, or two sites actually, near where I lived. I used to go and clean the pumps, empty the bins. I was shoveling the snow out of the car. Like, the car wash was insane back in early 90s. There's no hand car washes or anything. So any snowy, frosty day, they're so busy. I was shoveling them out, getting them gritted, getting them defrosted, getting the ice off the brushes. From a very young age, just loved being around them. A bit sad, really. So when I was at university, you could see the pain that one of the other dealer sites had gone. I think at the time it was BP Safe were taking over. Well, BP had taken over Mobile then. So we were left with one dealer site, our video library, and the freehold. And this other one had gone. And he carried on. He literally just treading water, keeping his head above the water, really, just to see what the next chapter in his journey would bring. I'd say his He had a good 80s, quite high, and low 90s, to be honest. I came, finished university, got a BA honours in business information technology. Quite enjoyed that. Came back and indirectly got involved in business, a bit like Joe's story that you've had on. I was in bed, a student just finished, I think it was the first Monday back from university, and I remember Dad shouting up the stairs, and, "What are you doing today?" I was like, "I don't know." And he said, "Well, you're not staying in bed." So that was it. I was like, "Oh, okay then." So I was in the car with him, and off we went to the garage. I didn't really know what I was going to do. I think about it now, actually. I think I probably always knew I was going to do this, because when I sat in the back of the Volvo, I liked it. I really liked it. I liked going around the sites. I liked the hustle and bustle on the sites. It was always busy. There's always people coming in. There was always stuff going on. Like, I remember it was Ginsters. We were on the first sites in the North. I used to put a Ginsters microwave in like maybe late 80s or something. It was like revolutionary at the time. But I just never forget these little things. And obviously some of the video memorabilia. I did enjoy it. So when he said, "Get out of bed, you're not staying in bed," I was like, okay. I knew what I was doing. I'd always been here. I'd been helping out. But I didn't think there was enough space for me in the business. So I was a little bit unsure of how I was going to get involved. I knew he couldn't really afford to pay me too much. So I just go and help out. Doing different things. I was actually stocking shelves and looking at the retail, doing orders, cleaning the shop, painting the shop, just little bits. I was keen. And I got stuck in. 3 months into me starting doing the shelves and doing the orders, I did increase the sales quite a lot in the shop. I went up to the bookkeeper at the time, was helping us out. And I said, "Oh, how have we made any difference in these extra sales?" And I discovered we were actually 3 months behind on our shift sheets. I said, "Can you not tell me if any of the work we've done over the last 3 months has made any impact to the business?" And it was a no, can't say it. So I went home to Dad and I was like, "Dad, we've got to change some stuff here. We need to know our actual position," which we didn't really know at the time. I think Dad had buried his head a little bit, if I'm honest. I think he'd tell you this. I just had a bit between my teeth. I had a fire in my belly and it was growing. And then I got under the skin at Oxford. The shop was doing well. We were 24 hours a day there, 7 days a week. I was running it. Did my fair share of night shifts when people were sick. We had an empty showroom, empty workshop. I took a personal bank loan out, bought some cars, put them in the showroom, painted the showroom. I got some cheap carpet tiles from somewhere. I put the carpet tiles down. Some old friends of Dad, then they were importing Mazdas from Ireland at the time in 2000, decided they didn't have the premises to sell them. We did. They would invest in the car, send them up, we'd sell them. And we sold quite a few because we still had a name for Mazda. So we did all right then. Not making major money, but we were doing enough to keep going.
At this point, was your dad still in and running the business? Like, or were you starting to take over the realms a bit more?
Yeah, so this is early 2000. I don't remember Dad being, he's always there, he's instrumental in it all, but I don't remember him being around too much in the showroom when I was doing the cars. I was back and forth to the auctions. I think I was doing the orders, cleaning the valet. And I didn't have any sales staff or anything. I was doing everything, valeting, buying, cleaning, selling, doing the adverts, doing a night shift if someone phoned in sick. He's always around Dad. He's still around now. He's keeping an eye over everything, keeps me in check. We don't always disagree. Luckily, it was a change of direction a bit further than the story, and like Dad supported that, and he still does. But luckily, he just let me at it. We did clash. We lived in the same house, and quite often we'd clash. And he gave me a life lesson quite early on in this, and we had a ding dong at work over something that won't even be that important. I went home, and normally I'd go in the lounge and say hi, poke my head in, say how you're doing, whatever. And this day, I was really annoyed because we'd had a bit of a fallout over something, and I just walked straight up to my room, shut the door. And he opened the door and he came up to my room. He said, "Son, work's work. Whatever happens at work stays at work. Home's home. We've got to leave it at work." I'll never forget that. And I never walked in, put my head in the door again. But it was hard work. It was hard slog. Real hard slog in them days, early 2000s.
So where did you go from there? So your dad stepped away more from the business. You're running around doing everything, which is quite a common story with forecourt operators. How did you grow the business to where it is today?
I really enjoyed the forecourt side of it. We were stuck on a 2.3, I think it was at the time, fixed price margin, not making loads at it, but selling loads. Like, we sold more then, way more then, with less cars on the road than we sell now, to be honest. Because we were price matching supermarkets. Back in the day, that was the price match deal. But My local pub was next to this site that I used to cut the grass on that my dad, this dealer site, my dad had to hand back. And I remember BP Safeway building this site, and they were building this huge shop. I just thought it was ridiculous, to be honest. Not many forecourts had, well, I didn't know any in the northeast that had a shop so big. But they built it. I went into it when they opened it. So this would be in 2005-ish. I thought, wow, this is nice. Obviously, how the supermarkets do it, this is Safeway at it. BP, the biggest fuel brand, one of the biggest fuel brands. This is how they do it. I didn't really think too much of it. And 18 months, 2 years later, I'm at the local pub next door at the time smoking. I cut the pints, went outside, having me fine. I looked over at this site. Don't know how I'd never noticed it before because I used to go to the pub quite a lot. And I noticed people going to this site, not for petrol. And the penny dropped. I just thought, hang on a minute. That big shop, people are going to this petrol site for the shop. I just thought, we've got the same, probably bigger piece of land over in Stockton. And I thought, this is what we need to do. Like, it's like I'd seen the future or something. It's just this crazy big shop. I thought it was
Drunken
nuts.
cigarette epiphany.
If I wasn't smoking, I might not have had thought, right, this is what we've got to do. That was it. I went home to Dad's, right, this is what we need to do, a big shop. So in like mid-2000s here, again, the money thing was a bit tight. So I'd sell a car, pay for the architect. And we got the plans drawn, took it home. It's like, Dad, this is what we're going to do. It's a 3,000 retail, 3,000 square foot shop, stood on just over 4,000 block in total with a storeroom and everything. Four petrol pumps and 20 parking spaces. And he just looked at me and just thought, you're absolutely nuts. I was getting rid of showroom, workshop, body shop, car wash, jet wash, existing forecourt with three pumps, little shop, 800 square feet. He just thought, honestly, he just thought it was nuts. And I said, no, this is it. And luckily, he just bought into it. He just went, okay.
Do you think there was some fear there after what happened with the Mazda and the investment that was made into a larger site? And maybe it wasn't so much that you were mad, but maybe it was a bit of a hangover from what happened back then.
He must have been a bit scared of it, but he also knew we were sat on an asset that was 20 knocking on for 25 years old, tanks in the ground. He put them in. There's a picture of me sat on the tanks as a kid, as a 6-year-old kid. I said, Dad, you only have to look under our counter. Under the counter was just insane. It just boggled my mind how many cables were under there. And some engineers just come out, used to repair stuff, leave the old stuff in. Some was live, some wasn't. I was like, the whole thing was just old, and it just needed renewing. Everything was falling to bits. We were putting sticking plasters on too many things. So I think he knew that we needed to do something. I know 100% that he didn't believe this was definitely the right thing to do, but he supported it. We got planning permission, sold a car, paid for that. Alcohol license, there's certain things that stick with me. In 2009, I think I probably applied for this. This was a complete no-no. I mean, where I am in the Northeast, just no, you're not having it. I had, at the court, there was a bus, a full-size coach of objectors, got on the bus next to our site, went down to the court to object on our license. I'd had barristers from London, everything to prove that people weren't going to fill the car up and drink a can of cider and drive off the forecourt. It wasn't many forecourts that had alcohol back then. That was a big battle. I think that cost us sick end of 15 grand or something. That was like three cars gone to pay for that. But I was told without that, we had a three-legged horse. We needed the alcohol for this to be a complete supermarket and to go punching with the likes of BP Safeway. I needed everything in there. So we did it. He supported it. Luckily, he liked the figures and he liked the fact it was one of the busiest. I think he just held on to that.
We were talking earlier about 2009 was the year you were deliberating whether to put coffee in. That decision to put in alcohol and have the more complete package, but you're still deliberating certain things that probably weren't the norm back then. Like alcohol wasn't available. Now you can get it in majority of petrol stations, or at least petrol stations can choose to put alcohol in. Now you see coffee in every single forecourt, but you didn't back then. So times have changed quite significantly. Seeing as there were so many decisions still to make, how did you decide what went in and what didn't?
We got the garage up and running. Luckily, we went from 7.5 grand a week to the 50 grand within about 4 months. But in doing that, we had a coffee debate just as we were about to open. Nice. We chose to go with Nice, new John from there. And he was fantastic with it. But I remember him and I having a big coffee debate because Nice wanted to film their first ever TV commercial they'd ever done at our brand new site that was just about to open. So I agreed to it. I just said yes to everything back then. Yeah, I'll do it. A crew of 50 people turned up. We had diggers and concrete half laid out the front, but the shop was fully done. So nice, I could film this TV. But all the chill products were in the fridge and shelves. It was a complete building site with a harass fencing around the front. You couldn't get on. And John was saying just before that, we need to have a coffee offering. I was like, coffee? I'm in the North Stockton, Northeast. I went, we need a cup of coffee, £1.60 a cup or whatever. I said, I don't think so. This is sort of 2010. He was like, you have to have it. It's on the TV, haven't it? And he said, I think it'll come. I said, hey, really? Some people just going for a cup of tea? This is like a genuine conversation in 2010. I was maybe a bit behind on what other people were doing, but we're chimney pot. We're not transient. So we had this debate. I ended up putting a Boston coffee, being a cup of coffee machine, lovely cup of coffee in. And we sold a couple, maybe, I don't know, 10 a day, 8 a day, which was more than I thought, to be fair. And then we did that for years. And then before we agreed, I backed down eventually and thought, I'm going to have to give up my 65% margin and put a bigger brand in because everyone's flying with Costa. Put it in, obviously, much less margin, but much more cash profit. Never looked back from that. It just seems crazy that we had a debate about coffee in 2010. Mm. It's just one of the first things we put in now.
What was it you were telling me about Michael earlier? What Michael said?
I've always been around gleaning information off things. I go to these, all the events, but certain things people say and you remember. And I remember Michael O'Loughlin, really top man. And I didn't know him. I can have a beer with him now, but I didn't know him then. We were at a conference and there was two things from that conference, two nuggets from that conference. One of them was BP M&S, I think it was. Or one of the mergers had agreed. And then Michael stood up and talked about coffee. This thing in my head, it was just like, it was always my site. I've got to have a bean, a cup of coffee. I don't want the instant coffee. I want to do this. I want to do that. I was just always thinking about me and my site, really. Not in any like arrogant way. It was just how I thought. I thought we all thought like that. And then Michael came out and just said, right, guys, everyone in this room, really, we need to be selling good bean to cup coffee. And it has to be of a good standard and consistent. And he said, we all do it well. Customers will then know they can pull into any of our sites and get a good cup of coffee. And I thought, oh, wow, all of us do it. I totally get that. Okay, then. So like, it was a complete change of thought process.
He was Apple Green at the time. So he had come over from Ireland. Michael himself will tell you about this. But ultimately, that food to go was already in Ireland. And it was consistent. So when you go to Ireland, and it's still there to, in this way to this day, like, you know, you go to pretty much any Irish petrol station, you're going to get a good breakfast. You're going to get a good selection. The breakfast rolls, that's what he talks a lot about, the breakfast rolls. So they were already a step ahead in that regards. It changed the culture of how people thought about petrol stations in Ireland. It's really interesting that that's found its way to you and you remember it from that particular event. Yeah. And then that contributed to you continuing to invest in coffee. And I think it's consistency by brand as well. People pull over and stop to go and get a Costa, but not a coffee, but a Costa specifically. And so I think it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that when you start putting the brands in on top of that, you look how well Greggs is now doing and Subway has done in the past. And then people see a petrol station on the map down the road, there's the expectation that that station is going to sell food. It's going to sell my lunch rather than just a sandwich that someone's made around the back 3 days ago, which is the old petrol station experience, if you're lucky.
We've had a shift from the, should I put a coffee machine in, to one's not enough anymore, and now I need at least two. So 2010, we opened that shop, did really well for us. We aimed at grocery on that. So this is our site in Oxbridge, my dad's first freehold. We just redeveloped that again. We've gone away a little bit from the groceries and extended the food for now a bit. Even though we're not that transient, but it's still proving to be good. We've got two coffee machines, all the snacking in between. Investing in this 40-foot kitchen. We've got a container on the side, which is converted into a kitchen, but it's just feeding all the donuts and the croissants and the Danishes now. And it's proven to be good. We've nearly threefolded the sales we were doing before on the bakery element of it. The reason for the shift in more for the food for now. In 2010, I didn't have an Aldi quarter of a mile up the road or a little three quarters of a mile the other direction. So the landscape had changed from what we created in 2010. I just feel people don't mind spending £3 on a coffee or £3.50 on a milkshake, but really aware that if your beans aren't as cheap as Aldi, they're aware of the price difference on some of the groceries. I love Ireland. I go there and see what they're doing. Culturally, so different, isn't it? Sites just phenomenal, aren't they? But you're a brave man if you try and replicate them over here, I think.
some of the Welcome Break sites and new ones that I've been to, they feel like they could be on the M50 around Dublin. If you look at America as well, America has these huge brands, and these brands are unbranded petrol station chains. What they're blessed with, which we're not so much in this country, is space and number of cars that can visit a particular space that happens to be in the middle of nowhere. Culturally over here, we're not quite ready for that. We're not there yet. We're still dealing with the branded offerings. We're still accepting the fact that you can get hot food in forecourts. I think if you ask my parents, for example, if they've ever eaten hot food out of a forecourt, they would still say no. So there's still an education to go in the market to get more people accepting that the younger generation don't know anything else.
The brands are fantastic and they massively help our business in all areas of the store and always have done. I do wish that sometimes we could just have a really good mince and dumpling offering and people embrace it and buy it. We get comfort from the brands, don't we?
Yeah. But you've got to start somewhere with a brand. McDonald's, it was a couple of guys selling burgers out of a kiosk at one point. You've got to start somewhere with a brand. And that brand identity, I think, is what's really important, how you build that out if you are going to do your own thing. I always come back to it. I really like what Yo Burger. Have you heard of Yo Burger?
Yeah.
What I like what they've done is they've got a unique differentiator in that you can get chocolate on your burger. I can tell you now, I don't want chocolate on my burger, but if I'm there, I'm probably going to try it. And I'm going to remember it. And I'm going to tell people about it. And I'm going to post about it on social media. And I might even go back to try one that doesn't have chocolate. And if I saw another Yo Burger, I'd be like, oh, that's the place that does the chocolate burgers. That's the key, isn't it? You need that unique differentiator. You need something about the brand which makes it stand out to turn it into a brand. There's a company up in Glasgow called GHSL. I think they're a six-site operator. And one of their sites has a slushy haven, I would call it, where they have, I think it's even more now, but 50 types of slushy, really high margin product. And they've dedicated a lot of the space in store to that product. And people know it. They come all over Scotland to come and go to the slushy petrol station. They're across from Ibox before Glasgow Rangers games. The forecourt's packed, but not with people filling up. It's people coming in for the slushies. It's difficult to do because you've got to take that risk. And then, like you said, you've looked at it before and you'd love to do something, but if the uptake's not there, ultimately it's just going to fail anyway.
So in 2000, a Country Choice went to the NEC show, bought a big double unit hot and cold oven underneath, converted just less than half the shop, but over a third of the shop into this food to go area. I've struggled on with food to go. It's had its ups and downs. For me, it's a key part of what the modern retail offering should have, so we've always kind of had it, and it we learned a lot from it. We had different things. We've got a Subway, and we learn from that. We learn from the systems and processes, and we look at, you know, how that goes against, and it sits well. I think it's a clean, fresh brand now with the fresh forward look. But yeah, every site's different, isn't it? And that consistency. We touched on the McDonald's earlier in coffee. And that consistent coffee offering, like McDonald's, probably fundamentally changed by having a good coffee offering. It's one of the companies I admire the most, just for how they've changed. I used to go and sit there as a kid with one of McDonald's looking at me and upstairs on the table. Now you can go and have a, we could go and have a meeting in there and a nice coffee and come along. My kids love it. It's the brand and the comfort from the brand. And you say about the slushies, you know, 7-Eleven with the Slurpees, the hot dogs, they do these. We're just not doing it in the UK as much, are we? We're using the brands, and there's a lot of really good brands out there, and I'm absolutely huge fan of them all. It is a bit of a risk to go on your own, isn't it?
There's a really good selection to choose from. It's so integrated with the petrol station industry that you're going to get. You go sit down with Subway, I'm going to have to go on this two-week course. I know the space and the size that it's going to take up, and I have a good understanding of how that might be run before I've even looked at it. And I think that makes it very attractive.
Not only are you getting a brand, you're getting a system, aren't you? You're getting a process. And that helps. So that helps with multi-sites. Three sites is nothing compared to what some guys have. But the more sites you have, the more system and process you need, the more discipline. I struggle with three, to be honest, keeping them all in line with the same systems and processes. These guys with loads and loads of sites, you need them. Companies that do that, that is what they do, their bread and butter. To come and give you that system and process, that's what you buy into, isn't it? And that then gives the customer that consistency.
It does make it even more amazing what the companies in America are able to do. Circle K is an incredible example, thousands of stations, and have that own brand consistency as part of their offering is incredible how that's run from the top down. I going on your website before we spoke, and I've been there before, but going today before we spoke, one of the things that always stands out to me is the vision, the mission, and the values that you have on your homepage as you scroll down.
Yes, it's interesting though, because quite a lot of people comment on this. It came about with a bit of pain, actually. In 2018, we built our new-to-industry third site on a tyre depot. I didn't see it coming. We built Oxbridge, went through all the process of that. So this was, I've done it, and I just thought, right, I've just got to build it, deliver it, open the doors. I thought I'd done the hard bit. And then what came, because it's a brand-new site, it was brand-new staff. These guys are trying their best, but they're so new to it. And as much as I was trying to send guys from other sites, this site was 40 minutes away from us. My second site was only a mile and a half up the road. Much easier to fix and get on with. This one, 40 minutes away, it was logistically different. Loads of guys will just think nothing of 40 minutes. But to me at the time, it was a long way, and I couldn't fix things as quick as we were with our second site. But that third site bolted on a third extra to our business, third extra staff, another 23, 24 bodies, another third extra volume, third extra shop volume, third extra systems and processes needed. It's not like a 10% year-on-year growth. It's just all this big lump, 33% comes at once. And then just things started falling over. I ended up running the subway myself for 2.5 months, I think, like literally went 7 days a week doing the orders, just trying to get it back on track. And there were so many things that I found some of the bits quite confusing. Some people were really good on lots of the time, but then weren't on other bits. So I was reaching out to everyone at the time for help. I had to do something. I ended up getting some leadership coaching. I started reading books at this point. I've never viewed things like this. Your tools have done you well to get you this far. And with these things, you've just got to keep adding tools into your box all the time to keep going. And one of the things that came from that was the mission, the vision, and the values. So I went away and spent a few weeks on this. It was simplicity. Everything has to be simple. I want it as simple as possible. And to make things simple often takes more time. So it came about from that. And then I realized some of the guys that were causing me a little bit of pain, that they had half the values and they didn't have the other half. So half the time they were good. Half the time I was so confused why they were. And it's because potentially their values didn't align, their personal values didn't align with our business values. So we've done our values. There's seven of them. The next one we're adding is actually embrace change, because I listen to podcasts. I reckon 10 years worth of change is happening in less than a year now, or something crazy like that. So one of my new values is embrace change. But it helps, because it helps us identify why it isn't working. Quite simple. We care deeply about our people, trust and integrity. People have to do the right thing when we're not there. And they have to be simple, because we've got maybe a 16-year-old in Subway, not specific, none of these quotes, and we've got a 60-year-old on another site on the petrol, or helping clean something. So many generations in the business now that the values have to be simple, but they all need to do the right thing when we're not there, can't be there 24/7. And they have to be relatable to everyone that works for us. So that's where it came from. I quite like our mission, which is to rescue shoppers from dirty forecourts, poor shops, and bad customer service. It's not that wordy, but it took so long to write. Yeah, it helps us. It really helps.
I've written a few mission statements. It takes the time to write an entire book to write just one sentence. And then you write the sentence, you look at it, you stare at it. It still doesn't land. You're like, is that really what we're trying to achieve? But I really like your mission. It's spot on. If that's the mission, then your stores that you operate, they're going to be clean, they're going to have good shops, and the customer service is going to be good. A mission could be to have good customer experience. And it's naff. Do you know what I mean? It's not saying anything. That's giving you the how in one sentence. I haven't seen many missions that get into the how without being too long. That's what I really like about it.
I want to be the best at what we do. But you then read, you go Google, and they say, don't say you want to be the best.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone wants to be the best. So we do want to be the best. And, but it's working. And it was that thing going back to what Michael said ages ago. If we all do it, we'll all benefit from it. I never really thought like that before. But
talk to me about embrace change, because We spoke before. We have a, okay, let me start that again. Sorry. Talk to me about the new value of embracing change, because we have a breakdown of retailers in the market, exiters, people who are leaving the market, existers, people who don't really want to make change, they're happy with the status quo, and excellers, which is a category I put you into. We were talking before, and you mentioned, do the existers maybe have it right? And I haven't heard anyone counter that in that way before. So I'm just curious what you exactly what you meant by that.
We've just done another refit. We spending money all the time. I remember sticking my head under the counter years ago when I joined all them wires and stuff. I just don't want any of that. Always going to be on top of things. So we've just spent quite a bit of money. This year we've got quite a lot going on. We've got a full lockdown rebuild on our second site, the smaller site, and we've just spent a fortune on revamping our main site at Oxbridge to add that food for now bit. It's changed our dynamic a bit. There's loads of. I'm always interested in how long do you wait before you do a refit? That's a question I'd love anyone to talk about on this podcast. Is it 10 years? Is it 15 years? Is there a time? I'm still trying to work it out. So we've just done it 13 years. Every time I go through the process, I'm walking. Am I nuts? Have I spent too much? Have the people who don't spend this just sweating assets? And plenty of people do. And I look at them, I think maybe they've got it right. Maybe I shouldn't be doing this. I don't think there is a right and wrong. I just think we're just different how we do things.
This is
The
like,
whole stuff.
the thing with the X's is, Heaven touched on this on from Park Garage Group on the podcast we did, is that ultimately people are in a position now where you've got a 5-year fuel supply contract coming up, your site needs a refurb, and ultimately your decision is, do I either invest in this business? Do I start thinking about and learning about EV, maybe hydrogen? Who knows what the narrative? There was a time, obviously, where diesel was the next big thing, right? And that look how that turned out. So the underlying question that retailers have is, am I prepared to go through another 5, 10 years of change? Do I want to learn something new? And I think that's a fair question to ask. And if you're going to exit them, you've got an asset that's worth a lot of money. You've probably got a decent amount of money in the bank if you've owned a or multiple petrol stations. And you're probably coming to an age as well, if you are an owner and not a next generation owner, most of those retailers are coming towards retirement age. So it's very easy to understand the exiter's position. And also how those exiters t sometimes don't do it and turn into excellers because they recognize they have to do one of the two. What I always find interesting about existers is I think back to what you were saying earlier about you've got all the wires under the desk and it's a nightmare. This isn't plugged in and the forecourt's dirty and it's old and all of this stuff. And surely that's more painful. As you said before, like there isn't as much pain. It's arguably more painful to have to work with the same old systems and processes. You've gone and you've changed and updated your processes and technology. I'm always thinking in the back of my head, at what point is that going to cost them, if at all? Because ultimately, they're still making the same source of margins. Then maybe they can't reach margins wise what some of the bigger, better stores can do. And actually, some of those stores aren't as reliant on their fuel margin. But they're certainly not taking in the shop. What you are. What is the catastrophic event that actually hurts these guys who aren't making a change? And when is it coming?
I don't think there's a right and wrong, to be honest. I personally just had that fire in my belly and wanted to go on and do something with the sites. We just wanted to do different things. Should we be spending that little bit more to stand out a little bit more and make that extra effort? Do we just do it? If a multiple came in, you looked at our stores and what we spend putting LED lights in these features. Now, quite a lot of independents are like this. I think we all think the same. We've got to punch a bit harder, higher, whatever. Against some of the malts because they've got the brand name above the door, which we haven't always had access to. I don't think necessarily there's a right and a wrong. I think you see the excellers are gonna, steam
I
ahead.
absolutely have a favorite. Yeah. It's not,
Yeah.
I'm not
Yeah,
gonna
but
lie. But I mean in my line of work, who responds to technology, ultimately we sell software. And for software, you invest money to get a return on that investment. The excellers see that as an opportunity, existers see it as an overhead. And that's one thing existers focused on is keeping overheads down. Excellers tend to be focused on growth, EBITDA growth, profit growth, and portfolio growth. So it is a completely different mindset. I also working for a software company, my world is all about growth. And so it's very difficult for me to wrap my head around wanting to stand still. That's why it always fascinates me. And I do wonder, could we get an exister onto the podcast? I'm not even sure an exister would have that much to talk about because
Oh, I mean,
ultimately they're just been doing the same thing every day for the last 40 years. So
they've probably got yachts, Caribbean, because we keep continuously invest, continuously invest, continuously invest. Their pot of money,
yeah, their
potentially
savings
bigger, you
account.
know, it's
Yeah.
potentially big, different stories. I think
It
that.
is. I met a retailer who I won't name by name. And I went to see him is up in and I went up there and I met him, really nice guy. I talked to him a bit about his site, how he does his pricing. He showed me he's got a spreadsheet, very typical conversation that we might have with a retailer, what the benefits are, how people have made money out of it, gave him examples. He said, look, I could change something, but why do I need to? I've got £4 million in the bank. And I said, he's got one site. I said, okay, you're right. You don't need this. I think I'll give you that. And he's carefully counted his money. He's managed to take an asset and sweat it to a point where it's given him a £4 million bank balance. Now, he may not have been telling the truth, or he may have had another business. There might have been more behind it. I don't know. But ultimately, if you're in that position, the incentive to move, unless you're motivated by other things, it's not there.
We wouldn't be here if I didn't do what we did in 2010. There's absolutely no chance. The wheels were going backwards. Every time I do something, every time I spend quite a substantial amount of money, I do think it was right, it was wrong here. Like when
I'm on your
we,
side. I'm on your side. I think you're right. Yeah.
yeah, no, like you say, it proved, if ever I doubt it was right, it was wrong. Like it, in 2010, like I genuinely, had we not done what we've done, I don't know what the story would have been.
But that's why you've got to keep doing it, John. You can exist. It's in the word. They're existing, especially with margins where they are these days. It is possible to run a petrol station today. But at what point could you get to where if we didn't make that change, then we would be finished now? You're taking a risk by investing, but you're taking at least an equal risk by not.
Arguably, though, the cost of living, the cost of labour in our shops now, maybe some of the most profitable sites at the moment are the ones single staffed, 800 square feet shop, a bit like what we used to have, easy maintenance, doing 80,000 litres if you can, so priced fairly competitively, taking your margin. Maybe that's more profitable than having a 40 grand a week store because of the
With
labour costs.
fridges, electricity.
There's an argument on both, isn't there?
I
It's
think
interesting. As you know, I love your weekly wrap when it comes through the stories. I think you ask like fascinating things. You view things, bigger picture. I said to you, why are you even doing this podcast? It's bigger picture stuff. So I listen to these and I just think open-minded. Hopefully, I'd like to, everyone to come on wherever they see themselves as an exister, exeter, exceller. That'd be interesting, very interesting.
What would you say if you had to pick kind of one secret sauce? The sauce has often multiple ingredients. What's the secret sauce to running a successful forecourt business?
The secret sauce, and it's any business, is accounts. A set of management accounts monthly that you can understand. I don't understand a lot of the data that goes in and out of them, but I understand the management accounts are put in front of me. The 15-page document, I understand that. That fundamentally changed our business. That allowed us to focus on the right areas. That allowed us to focus on the areas that were underperforming, departments that weren't making as much margin as they should. That fundamentally, in my mind, changed our business.
That is a huge difference from being 3 months behind on your bookkeeping.
That was just crazy. I went on to dad that night and said, we've got to do this. At the end of the month, we sit down, looked at these accounts. And the pleasure was, because when I was doing that, when I had to make that decision in 2009 to develop 2010, my wife didn't agree, my dad wasn't keen, Ian, my accountant, didn't think it was the right thing to do. My dad's business was a forecourt with a shop on it. And I think what I was trying to develop was a shop that sold petrol. And it's like a fundamental turn on its head in the business. And it's not, absolutely not taking anything away from petrol. I love petrol. I love that part of the business.
What's going to be the key difference between the forecourt of today and the forecourt in 10 years' time?
If we look back 5 years, in my mind, not a lot. Like, I can't see hoverboards coming in there. I'm not naive to electric. It's there, but we did the LPG. It's there, providing us incentivization for it. Figures are showing that would you buy a person like a normal person at home? It's not a company director, doesn't get any car allowance, whatever. But a normal person go out and pay out for a fully electric, and we can see the government are disincentivizing at the moment. The company car taxes are changing a bit. It's in the government's hands, isn't it? Once that incentivization's been there, I think it's hard to take it away because people view it as it should have it. So the new site we built in 2018, went to the grid, I thought we'll put a charger, a 50 kilowatt charger in the back.
That'd be
Just,
a £1 million, please.
well, test the water with it, get an understanding of it. I went to the electric board, I need 100 kVA for my shop and refrigeration, whatever. 50 kVA for the charger, 115 total, please can I have it. Came back, no, you can have 117, that's it, or £500,000. And we literally go over to the side of the railways, down the road, and whatever, whatever. I was like, no chance. So there goes the electric charger. I'll just have the 117 for the shop, and we'll have a look at it again another time. So there's hurdles, isn't it? I think we'll be continuing to try and develop the retail. 25 years ago, I joined, we had video libraries, and we've been on a few journeys since. But whatever it is, it's going to make money. Guys will be all over it,
I can't remember where I saw it. I saw a doggy wash station recently.
There's one. Yeah, there's a few guys got me up them years ago. Yeah, these guys are full-on entrepreneurs in this industry. Real interesting characters, done some amazing stuff, and will continue to do amazing things. And I just think it'll continue. It's just not going to not continue. But whether we all have electric and no fuel, definitely not in 5 years. For me, might be wrong. Good thing about these podcasts, someone can play it back and prove you're wrong, can't they?
That's a great point.
Well, who knows? Who knows?
Yeah. Better make sure I delete these after a while so no one can accuse me
In
of being
five
wrong
years, four
ever.
and a half
Yeah.
years, get rid of it. But I
No,
don't know.
I'm very used to being proved wrong. Like, I used to predict the oil price every year. I don't think I got it right once. I didn't get anywhere near it. You can't predict the future. No one
No.
really knows, but I think what you can do is prepare for it. That's what you're doing. So you're safeguarding the future. When you think about fuel as a shop that sells fuel, that is a really good way of looking at it.
Obviously, all electric cars need a wash. So there's a good market there for the washing, providing the laws just tidied up a bit. I thought we would actually do this conversation without COVID mentioned, but fundamentally, so many things happened in it. But what we were just talking about there is overnight, 80% of our fuel went. But because we developed shops that sold fuel, the shops just kicked it. We lost 80% of the fuel, and the shops just went up. We were buying bulk eggs, packing, separating them out, packing them, splitting the toilet
Toilet
rolls.
paper.
Yeah, toilet paper gate. Yeah, like the millionaires with 18 of them on the windowsill. But when I look back now, like we traded really well because the shops were doing like 140, 150, 160% of what they were doing, and they're already quite healthy. I've always been, especially with dad and what happened to the business and stuff. I see all the eggs were in one basket. You had the cars and the forecourts, but it felt like all the eggs were completely in a basket. And I've just always wanted to make sure as best I could, without being distracted, because I think I'm quite easy to get distracted, that I keep the eggs separate and the revenue separate and the profit centers a bit separate. And they can kick in. Something goes wrong with the shop, we have some supply issues, the fuel will kick in, hopefully. And if, like COVID, the fuel goes, the shops will kick in. That's the plan. When one half of it's worked.
Yeah, well, you're covering both bases with the overhead costs of having a forecourt. It's very difficult if fuel disappears. The business costs have risen so much. Inflation's just killed everything. Your energy bill goes up three, four times, maybe even five, I've heard. I don't think a business survives off cokes and smokes anymore.
There's always something we can be doing on the forecourts. There's always more to be doing in the shops. We're surrounded by categories that are declining.
The next big thing is always the question.
When you know, let me know.
Thanks to John for taking part in Fuel Matters. We've got a mix of top 50 independents and smaller operators coming up in the next few episodes, so make sure that you subscribe and give us 5 stars. Thanks for listening.